This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. It's our weekly news review today. We start in Columbus with state government reporter for the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, Laura Bischoff. Laura, welcome back to our program.
Hey, hello, Cincinnati.
Indeed. It's always busy where you hang out, and this week was certainly no exception. I want to talk about this anti-COVID vaccine legislation, and then we'll ultimately hear a little bit of testimony that has become quite controversial and widely ridiculed across the country that took place in Columbus this week. But first, talk a little bit about this legislation that may even play a role in the governor's race. What's at stake here? What's being proposed?
Well, you know, this House Bill 248 is, it goes beyond just COVID vaccinations. It is a broad wish list of the anti-vaccination / medical freedom group. It would block employers from requiring vaccinations as a condition of employment. That's something that hospitals oppose because they want to make sure that their employees have flu shots if they're working with fragile patients. It would allow Ohioans to skip any vaccination by just making a written or verbal declaration. They want to require schools, K-12 schools, to explicitly tell parents about existing exemptions that allow them to skip childhood vaccinations, which includes a reasons of conscience, which is sort of like a catch-all philosophical reason. It would prohibit forcing unvaccinated people to wear masks in your business. It would repeal a requirement that college students be vaccinated against hepatitis B and meningitis before they're allowed to live in the dorms. So it's a broad-ranging bill, and it has huge support in the conservative medical freedom groups. It's unclear what kind of support it has in the House overall, and if it's got the legs to move through the legislature.
Who are the lawmakers, or the lawmaker behind it?
So Jennifer Gross, who's a Republican from Westchester, is the primary sponsor behind it. She's a registered nurse, and she has been kind of the driving force behind it. She's the primary sponsor.
So we know that there are so-called anti-vax people out there. They've found communities online in recent years and occasionally draw widespread attention to themselves. But is the widespread promotion of the COVID vaccine drawing up the current anger about vaccines in general, because this is on everyone's mind?
Sure. I think that there's a lot of people that kind of chafe at the idea that their individual freedoms would be dictated by government. And that has always been present. But I think that the coronavirus pandemic has really kind of heightened that awareness and that sensitivity to those issues.
You say it's unclear what kind of support it has in the legislature beyond its Westchester sponsor. But do we know of any other lawmakers so far that are behind it?
Well, yeah, I don't know who all is. I was looking at it's currently pending in the Ohio House Health Committee, which is chaired by Scott Lipps, former mayor of Franklin. And he has expressed support for medical freedom ideas in the past. I'm not sure where he stands on this bill at this moment. The House Health Committee does have some conservatives on it, but it also it's unclear whether or not the House Health Committee wants to go this far with this bill. There's another hearing next week, and I think there's possible amendments queued up. And also, you know, they've had proponent testimony in the last couple of hearings, and coming up will be opponent testimony, which will include a lot of business groups and medical groups.
Let's hear some commentary that was offered in the State House this week. We've got a couple of different clips here, one from a physician and another from a nurse. This took place this week during a hearing on House Bill 248. Josh, can we hear those?
And some of the information that I think had been discussed on your podcast related to EMF frequencies.
That was a thought.
And
it was because we're all kind of hypothesizing. I mean, what is it that's actually being transmitted that's causing all of these things? Is it a combination of the protein, which now we're finding has a metal attached to it? I'm sure you've seen the pictures all over the internet of people who've had these shots and now they're magnetized. They can put a key on their forehead, it sticks. They can put spoons and forks all over them and they can stick, because now we think that there's a metal piece to that. There's been people who've long suspected that there was some sort of an interface, yet to be defined, an interface between what's being injected in these shots and all of the 5G towers. Not proven yet, but we're trying to figure out what is it that's being transmitted to these unvaccinated people.
That was Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, a physician from here in Ohio, also the author of Saying No to Vaccines. We also heard during that hearing from Joanna Overholt, an RN from Strongsville. Let's hear that, Josh.
Yes, vaccines do harm people. By the way, so I just found out something when I was on lunch, and I wanted to show it to you. We were talking about Dr. Tenpenny's testimony about magnetic vaccine crystals. So this is what I found out. So I have a key and a bobby pin here. Explain to me why the key sticks to me. It sticks to my neck, too. I got this. Yeah, so if somebody can explain this, that would be great.
And we're talking with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Laura Bischoff. Laura, those keys, that bobby pin, they did not stick to that nurse, even though she was suggesting that she would somehow be magnetized by a COVID-19 vaccine, and Dr. Sherry Tenpenny's suggestion that the vaccines magnetize as well, also debunked. Can you talk a little bit about the reaction to that testimony?
Well, it went viral. I mean, it was all over the internet. It drew some national press attention. Sherry Tenpenny is a licensed physician in Ohio. She's also a purveyor of anti-vaccination information and has a website and offers like an online boot camp for, dismissing vaccine information. So she's pretty well known. And it's interesting, the first voice that you heard in the first clip was from Dr. Beth Liston. She's a state representative, a Democrat from Dublin outside of Columbus. She is an MD and holds a PhD in public health, and she's on faculty at Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. And Liston told me later that she purposely asked Dr. Tenpenny, those questions to draw out her extreme views. Tenpenny is very well known as a conspiracy theorist and an anti-vax person.
And we should note, based on your reporting, that it is Westchester Republican Jennifer Gross, the state representative from there, who is the primary sponsor of the legislation we're talking about, House Bill 248. She's the one who insisted that Dr. Tenpenny testify before this committee. You cite House Health Committee Chairman Scott Lipps, also a Republican from Franklin, as saying he allowed Tenpenny to testify at Gross's insistence, right?
Yes. So that means that the House Republicans gave a pretty big platform to a well-known disinformation spreader.
Has Governor Mike DeWine had anything to say about the testimony or the legislation or both?
Yeah, so yesterday he was having his Vax-a-Million winner press conference, and he offered up that he opposes House Bill 248 and that he thinks that the current law is sufficient and that vaccines are important, and that he reminded people that we don't have polio anymore because of the vaccine. We don't have, measles, mumps, tetanus, et cetera, because of vaccines. Vaccines have really saved millions of lives and improved health overall.
We will be talking about a revisiting of the polio vaccine and the impact that it had on this country at the time that it was brought out towards the end of our program later in the hour with AP reporter Dan Sewell. But for now, we're still talking with USA Today Network Ohio Bureau reporter Laura Bischoff. Let's move away from the vaccine testimony and legislation, and let's talk about public corruption in Ohio, which has been a hot topic in recent years, considering what went down with the former House Speaker. There is apparently a move to push some of these corruption cases that involve state charges from Franklin County, where most of them or all of them are tried and prosecuted, to where?
Well, so the Ohio Constitution requires that criminal cases are prosecuted in the county in which the crime occurred. However, State Representative Bill Seitz from Cincinnati, Republican, longtime member of the legislature, has a bill that would allow the defendant to ask for a change of venue on public corruption cases so that the defendant could be prosecuted in their home county. Now, this would not impact the householder case. The householder case is pending in U.S. District Court, but it would impact cases of public corruption, involving state lawmakers or state employees who are based in Franklin County.
So, what has the reaction been to this? Has there been any pushback from opponents?
Well, it's unclear. The bill got amended earlier this week. It's still pending in committee, I think in the Civil Justice Committee. And this is an idea that was floated a couple of times in previous legislatures and was shut down. So it's unclear. It's kind of early to see if it's got momentum in the House, and then of course it would have to get through the Senate and then get signed by the governor. So we'll see. I think that it probably would not be well received right now, given that Ohio is facing the biggest public corruption case in the nation and the biggest case in Ohio history.
And you reported this week that federal prosecutors have handed over 1.2 million pages of documents to the defense in that corruption case?
Yeah, the 1.2 million, that came out as a detail in a status conference call that happened yesterday. And that was from the Assistant U.S. Attorney, Emily Gladfelter, who's the lead prosecutor on the householder case. And she said the 1.2 million pages of documents doesn't include another couple of batches that are expected to be delivered by August. And it also doesn't include documents that are from imaged devices, which would be like a cell phone, a hard drive off of a laptop, et cetera. And I imagine there's probably plenty of those. So I don't know how long it would take you to read 1.2 million pages, but it would take me quite a while.
So this, we should just reiterate for our listeners' sake, that this is the federal bribery case that involved former House Speaker Larry Householder, Republican, and others in an alleged $60 million bribery scheme, also involving First Energy Corporation based out of Akron. And I think a lot of people recognize that as House Bill 6, right? Something connected
right
to that.
House Bill 6 passed, right. House Bill 6 was signed into law by the governor in July of 2019, and it's a $1.3 billion bailout, mostly for First Energy up in Akron to keep their nuclear power plants open. And then in July of 2020, the FBI swooped in and arrested Larry Householder, Matt Borges, who's the former chair of the Ohio Republican Party, lobbyists Neil Clark and Juan Cespedes, and then political operative Jeff Longstreth. Longstreth and Cespedes have pleaded guilty. Clark died by suicide in March down in Florida, and then Householder and Borges have pled not guilty.
So you just talked a little bit about how long it might take someone to read 1.2 million documents. Does this delay any progress in this prosecution?
Well, so the next status conference is bumped to September 2nd. The Judge Black in U.S. District Court has named this as a complex litigation, and so the speedy trial rules have been kind of put on hold by agreement by both sides. It could take quite a while to get this launched off to trial. I mean, since they just bumped it again to September 2nd, and they announced 1.2 million pages, I think that it's going to be quite a while. And then the other big development that we're kind of waiting on is that First Energy disclosed that it is in early talks with the Department of Justice to get a deferred prosecution agreement. So that would be like a chance for them to avoid getting a criminal conviction, and that they would participate in the case as cooperators. I don't know when that's going to come through, but that would, I think, will be the next development.
Well, we know Larry Householder is no longer Speaker of the House. What's his status as a lawmaker?
Oh, well, funny you should ask. So we're talking like 300-plus days since his arrest. The House Republicans and Democrats just began debate yesterday on two different resolutions to expel him from the House. under a rarely used provision in the Ohio Constitution. The last guy to be expelled was John Slow, 167 years ago, I think, because that guy punched another lawmaker in the face.
Oh, man. All right. Well, that's not happening right now, at least. So we want to give our thanks to Laura Bischoff from the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau. Laura, thank you so much for your reporting and sharing it with us today. Really appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
You got it. And up next, there's an audit underway of development deals approved by Cincinnati City Council. We'll talk about why a northern Kentucky city opts not to ban abortions, even though there are already no providers there. And a look back at the way the polio vaccine changed lives. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue our weekly news review now at Cincinnati City Hall with WVXU reporter Becca Costello, who joins us via Zoom. Becca, how are you?
I'm doing great, Michael. Thanks.
So City Council has obviously been rocked by indictments, multiple indictments on federal bribery charges, all related to developments and developers. And it looks like some form of a reform attempt is taking place with an audit of a lot of developments and the associated ordinances adopted by City Council. Tell us about it.
That's right. Well, I'm sure our listeners will remember three of the indictments at City Hall were related to economic development deals, with council members allegedly taking money in exchange for favorable votes on specific developments. And so, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about, is there more going on that the city just isn't aware about because it's been behind closed doors? So council has asked for a forensic audit, and city administration put out a request for proposals to see how much this would cost. And just this week on Wednesday, council approved $150,000 for that audit. They're going to look at all or most economic development deals in 2018, 19, and 20. And it's about 200 ordinances, and they say it'll take about 4 months.
So what exactly will these contractors be evaluating?
So they're looking for inconsistencies or irregularities, rather, in these council votes. And so basically looking for, say, if one development deal was passed, if that developer maybe paid some campaign donations to that council member around the time of the vote. It's not exactly clear how much detail will be in these posts. There was some questions at council about that from council members asking, you know, what kind of information will come back with this report. It's not exactly clear what all we'll get, but they're definitely looking for things that are irregular and that might point to some more misconduct that we're not yet aware of.
Meanwhile, there are other funding issues that the city council is weighing right now because it's still budget season. So where are we in the budget process?
Yes. Happy budget season, by the way, before I forget.
To you as well and yours.
So right now, the city manager has released her proposed budget, and typically that goes to the mayor, who then has the chance to make changes. There were basically no changes from Mayor Cranley from this proposed budget. There were three public hearings held, the most recent two this week, and council members are now working on their proposed changes to that general draft. So filing motions of what they'd like to see changed. And hopefully there'll be more information at Monday's Budget and Finance Committee meeting. They're going to work out some of the details as far as what the changes council members want to see, and then plan to have hopefully a vote on the final budget on June 23rd, although they do technically have until the end of June to approve the budget.
What does this budget look like when it's compared to previous ones? We know that earlier in the pandemic, a lot of municipalities were extraordinarily concerned about the hit they were going to take, and then a lot of relief came through. What's different?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this year especially, the city was expecting to make some significant cuts. Obviously, income is down because of things like even just something as simple as parking downtown. You know, those aren't bringing in as much funds as they would during a non-pandemic year. But the American Rescue Plan, the latest round of stimulus, has really filled that deficit. About $67 million is being used to fill the deficit for fiscal year 2022. So most departments are actually getting an increase in budget for that first year. But this is a biennial budget for fiscal year 2022, but then also fiscal year 2023. And looking at that second year, we are going to have some cuts. So the city is looking to have some cuts for those departments. And, you know, one of the wild card elements here is income tax revenue. The city has set aside a lot of the American Rescue Plan funds just in case they have to pay back some of the income tax collected from people working at home outside the city. And that depends on some lawsuits that are ongoing right now. But if the city doesn't have to pay back that money, then those funds will be freed up to use for other things.
I guess I'm wondering if any members of council have announced some specific changes that they want to see to the budget as it currently stands.
We do know a couple of specific changes so far. Now, council members were asked to submit their proposed changes to the budget by noon today. So we'll know more about that as we check those. Those are filed with the clerk this afternoon. But so far, a couple of things that we're pretty likely to see change. One, there was a lot of discussion about the DIVERT program. This is a program from the nonprofit Women Helping Women. It's a domestic violence response where they send specialists with police who are responding to domestic violence situations. It's had a lot of success based in research and seems to be doing some great work. Was not included in the draft of the budget, but there's a lot of support on council to get $250,000 for that program. Another area we've seen council members already requesting a change is with the Citizen Complaint Authority, which is that independent police oversight board. They are fully funded, but they've asked for an additional $400,000 to hire even more staff to, in part, work on a big backlog of cases. And there's a strong support on council for that funding request. And then one other is the Playhouse in the Park new space. They've broken ground on that, and it is actually a city-owned facility. They need about $500,000 to fill the gap in financing for that project. Was not included in the initial draft, but a couple of council members have put forth motions to get that included in the budget.
Becca, we know that these members of council don't always get along and that there are occasionally public disagreements. Should we expect any particular battles as it relates to the budget?
Well, I've heard so far there's going to be general agreement on kind of the big priorities. Unlike some of the fights we saw with the American Rescue Plan funding, there was some definitely a big split on that. But one area we've seen so far is Councilmember Steve Gooden, interim council member rather, Steve Gooden has put forth a proposal to use $20 million for a new District 5 Cincinnati Police Department headquarters. Now, District 5 has been a source of contention for many years. They're in a temporary space in a strip mall that was never intended to be a permanent space. But a $20 million request would be a huge change from the current capital budget. And so it would be interesting to see what that discussion is like. It would require quite a few changes to what's been proposed right now.
And we should expect more discussion on Monday at the Budget and Finance Committee.
That's right, 1 p.m. Already heard all the public comment, but Committee Chair Councilmember David Mann hopes to have most of the details hammered out on Monday and have those ordinances introduced to hit that deadline of finalizing by June 23rd.
You can follow WVXU reporter Becca Costello's stories at WVXU.org, in addition to hearing them right here on 91.7 FM. Becca, thanks for spending part of your Friday with us. Hope you have a great weekend.
Thanks, Michael. You too.
And let's continue the weekly news review now on the Kentucky side of the river with Inquirer Northern Kentucky reporter Julia Fair, who joins us via Zoom. Julia, welcome back to our program.
Hey, Michael. Thanks for having me.
I'm so glad to have you back on. Take us to Edgewood. This is a city in Kenton County, sort of one of those 275 suburbs, mm-hmm. home of St. Elizabeth Healthcare, but notably not any abortion clinics. However, mm-hmm. the city council there was considering whether or not they should ban abortion clinics. Mm-hmm. What was going on?
So this kind of goes back to May 17th. At the May 17th Edgewood City Council meeting, a resident attended and he asked city council members to ban abortions, just like the city of Lebanon did in Ohio. So after that, they I read about that from the River City News, which I like to call everywhere at once, River City News. And so I was like, okay, I've got to keep an eye on this. And so I thought, I was expecting them to put it on the agenda for the next meeting, but then the Friday at noon, the agenda for that Monday's meeting came out and it wasn't on the agenda. So I was like, okay, like maybe they'll talk about it in a few more weeks. But then about 2.5 hours before the meeting on Monday, a new agenda came out and there was a new bullet point that said they were going to discuss an ordinance to ban abortion clinics. They didn't introduce an ordinance on Monday. They just talked about it. And so that came because the constituent asked them to consider it in May. And so they really quickly discussed it, maybe for 3 to 5 minutes, and then they tabled it. They said, you know, they wanted to wait to see what happens to Roe v. Wade in the next few months. They also had some zoning questions. And so they tabled it. So it might come up again, but that's the update from Edgewood.
Certainly. And these are people who are, they seem to express their own opposition to abortion in general.
Yes.
I understand there
mm-hmm.
was a lot of references to their own Catholicism, that, you know, mm-hmm. this major Catholic healthcare provider in Northern Kentucky is headquartered in that
mm-hmm.
city.
Mm-hmm.
And right across the street is Thomas More University, the Catholic higher education institution. So there was a lot
yes.
of, you know, commentary about, you know,
mm-hmm.
we're all Catholics here. We don't like abortion, but there's
yes.
no reason to act on this now until some judicial review is conclusive.
Yeah, council member Jeff Shriver, I think, said, like, kind of summarized it the best way. He said, "I think it's safe to say that everyone on council is against abortion, but I do not believe this is an issue city council should be considering at this time." You know, they had concerns about lawsuits and then the city having to pay expensive attorney fees. So they just kind of want to wait to see what happens with Roe v. Wade before they put city resources toward this.
All right, from Edgewood, let's go to Florence. Y'all, Florence is the second largest city in Northern Kentucky and the largest in Boone County. And Florence has its feelings hurt right now because of a
mm-hmm.
decision by the Boone County Public Library Board. Why don't you tell our listeners why Florence and the County Library Board are upset with each other right now?
Yeah, so there's going to be a new library in Boone County, but where that's going has stirred a lot of controversy. So basically, about 30,000 people live in the city of Florence. It's the second largest city in our three-county region here in Northern Kentucky. And so they want a new library. But for years, the library board's plan has been to build a new, larger library in the city of Walton to serve southern Boone County. And so that's been the plan for about 20 years. The library board also hired a consultant in 2019 to look at their plans again, just to see if it was still fitting the future growth needs in Boone County. And the consulting firm said yes, also, that the new library should go in Walton to serve that part of Boone County. And so Florence officials didn't really, they had a lot of qualms with the consultant's report. They were, questioning if the report was completely unbiased. They had concerns because the library board is the one who paid for it. And they also were concerned that the consultant knew about the board's previous plans to build the new library in Walton. So when that was reinforced, they a few officials were concerned about that.
Well, let's note, though, that, I mean, there is mm-hmm. a library branch in Florence, of course. Oh, yes. And yes, it's a mm-hmm. smaller one than they think they need. It's about 50 years old. And the consultants that you referenced said, well, sure, let's just improve this library. Spend about $4 million renovating it by the end of 2026. Why doesn't the city like that plan?
You know, the city doesn't like that plan because they're calling it another Band-Aid. They say that, you know, it's another Band-Aid because they just want a larger library than the one that they will end up getting after this renovation. And so that's why they don't like that plan.
And what about the city officials in Walton, which is a much smaller city? I think about mm-hmm. 4,000 people live in Walton compared to about 30,000 in Florence. But they do have a city council and a mayor, of course.
Yes.
What's their position on, yeah, we do deserve this over our larger sister to the north?
Yeah. So when I spoke to officials from Walton, they said, look, we understand why Florence is going to bat for their constituents. They said if it was the other way around, they would go to bat for their constituents, too. But they also said, you know, here's a great quote from the mayor of Walton, Gabe Brown. He said, I feel the new library is very justified. It's well deserved. Walton has waited patiently. And Walton's library, I forget how large it is right now, but it's going. The new one is going to be about three times the size of their current one. And you know, in Walton too, the library board director told me that it's too small to have any type of programming there, and that they've pulled out just about all of their programming from that building, which has not happened in Florence. Florence officials want more programming. But they have not had programs pulled out of it because of the size, as far as I know.
And so there are 6 branches of the Boone County Library, and the Walton branch is 5th in annual attendance, according to your reporting, with just mm-hmm. over 55,000 annual visitors, whereas Florence is 3rd. I should correct myself there. Walton is 4th, and Florence is 3rd with about 124,000 there. So this is a situation involving mathematics. I mean, does Walton say, well, look, our numbers are smaller than Florence's, but if we had the larger library and were able to offer programming, perhaps the numbers would be better?
The city that focused on the math was Florence officials. And so the Florence mayor, Diane Whalen, she made the argument that Florence is actually more crowded than the Walton branch. So she calculated that there were about 10.6 visits in the Florence library per square foot in 2018. She did that by dividing the number of Florence branch square footage the number of visits divided by the square footage. So that's 10, that was 10.6 visits per square foot in Florence. And then I did the calculations for Walton, and Walton has 8.2 visits per square foot. So the Florence was really focusing on the math to kind of show that they believe that their library is more crowded.
So is there another step? Is there something more to come in this city versus city battle over a library?
You know, when I spoke to the library board, it sounded like that the current board did sign off on this plan. But the plan is, you know, it's guidance. Every time a city or a government signs off on like a 10-year, 20-year plan, it's guidance for the future. So could things change legally? Yeah. But it looks like the library board is moving ahead with plans to, you know, get this new library in Walton built. Because another thing that we haven't noted is that there are 2 pieces of land that both cities have ready available for something to be built there. But the library board bought the land in Walton for, I think it was over $1 million some years ago, with a plan to build a library there. And Florence bought their piece of land, I think it was in 2017.
So the difference is the library board purchased the land in Walton, yeah, whereas the land in Florence was purchased by the city.
Right. So the library board wants to, you know, build something on the thing that they have already purchased.
Julia Fair is the Northern Kentucky reporter for The Inquirer. Julia, thank you for spending part of your Friday with us. Hope you have a great weekend.
Sure thing. Thank you. You too.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We wrap up the weekly news review now with Associated Press reporter Dan Sewell, who joins us via Zoom. Dan, welcome back to Cincinnati Edition.
Yeah, thank you, Michael, for having me on again.
Of course. You did a really deep dive into the way people felt about the polio vaccine all those years ago and the way those same folks feel about the COVID vaccines now and the type of wisdom we can learn from them. I thought it was so interesting the way you framed the opening of this story, because it's something that I personally had not considered before, that polio was impacting children back then, and COVID is affecting those same people the most all these years later, as it more disproportionately impacts older people where they find themselves in life right now. Talk a little bit about the work you did on this.
Right. Okay. Thank you. I had done a story earlier this year on how grandparents were doing during the pandemic. And I worked with Joniko Kochi, who is director of the Parenting Institute at Adelphi University. And after that story, she was saying it would be interesting to talk to people, you know, from an earlier generation who survived a crisis and compare it to now. And so around that time, there was a photo that surfaced from the Yellow Springs newspaper of Governor Mike DeWine as a second grader in 1955 getting the polio vaccine. So that kind of, you know, tied it together. And I found some people to talk to who, you know, both have children or grandchildren now, and they were children that were young adults at the time of the polio epidemic, which really, I think, you know, a lot of people don't realize just how bad that was. It was throughout the late 1940s. I think there's an average, the CDC said about 15,000 people were paralyzed a year. At its peak, there were nearly more than 3,100 people who died in 1 year. So, and then the other difference is it took very long time to develop a vaccine compared to COVID.
And, you know, the polio vaccine is one that I think a lot of us have a trivial knowledge about. You know, we can say Jonas Salk, for example, if we're watching Jeopardy, but you're right. I don't think the impact that it had on that entire generation is fully understood now, except by the ones who were there, like Governor DeWine, to whom you spoke as part of this this article that you did for the AP. And, you know, it's interesting because the governor has led the state through the COVID-19 pandemic with, you know, varying degrees of criticism and support, of course, and even some strong criticism from members of his own party. But he's very pro-vaccination as a method of beating COVID. And as we look at the vaccination rates among age groups, the older people have done pretty well by percentage. Did you gain any knowledge as you were doing this piece that their experience as youths combating polio influenced their decision to jump right up and get the COVID-19 vaccine first?
I think so, because they've seen how successful that vaccination program was. You know, it was rolled out in 1955, the Salk vaccine. There was an oral version that became available a few years later. And by the 1960s, it was down to fewer than 100 cases a year in the United States. And in the 70s, it was fewer than 10 a year. And finally, it was considered eradicated in 1979 in the United States. So I think they, you know, they saw that and they say, yes, you know, I'm going to get vaccinated because I see that those vaccinations work. One of the contrasts that several of them brought up is the polio affected primarily children. So parents were going to be very relieved and anxious to get their children vaccinated, whereas, you know, COVID, it's a little bit different situation. So,
right. But nationally, I think a lot of us felt a certain amount of relief when the vaccines were confirmed and as they started to roll out, because that was presented as the path back to some sense of normalcy. And your article does explore the sense of relief that people during the polio era must have felt. What was different about the emergence of the vaccine then compared to the COVID vaccine now? I know you've already mentioned the short amount of time it took to get the COVID-19 vaccine comparatively.
Right. I think, you know, it's probably hard for us to realize the fear that, you know, polio caused. And think about it, you know, we had a president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who suffered from polio. And you know, like Mike DeWine talked about, you know, his parents didn't want him to go to Reds games for a while because they knew someone who was convinced that his son had caught polio by going to a St. Louis Cardinals game. I can vaguely remember some of these things. You know, I was growing up in the late 50s, but I remember my mother wouldn't let us go swim in pools, other people's pools or public pools, because that was a place that was believed could be spread. So again, I think it was just a major breakthrough when an effective vaccine came out. Now compared to COVID, there's, you know, we're in a different time. Some of the people I interviewed talked about the politics are very divisive, and things spread very quickly, such as the idea that, you know, you can become magnetized by by the vaccine,
right?
So, as you talked about earlier.
Yes, of course. We did talk about that a little bit earlier, and you noted that we had a president who had polio. We had a president who had COVID. So,
right.
we've seen politics play a role in these ailments, but the responses have been different. The previous president was sort of muddy on the national response to COVID-19. The newer president is pretty aggressive in trying to unify people to get vaccinated and other mitigative methods to stop this virus. I'm wondering what you learned from some of the people you talked to about the COVID generation, right? I mean, there are people who came up during polio. What type of lasting impact will this pandemic experience have based on the knowledge shared by those who had the previous experience?
Well, one of the points that Joniko Kochi wanted to make with this story was that, you know, different generations live through really challenging times. And, you know, to her way of thinking, you know, you survive and then you come out, you know, with a new set of skills. And, you know, there's going to be lasting things from COVID that, you know, some of the sanitary and hygienic protections we use now will probably linger. And one of the people I interviewed, she was a student nurse during the polio time, and she remembered, you know, treating young people in iron lungs that they needed to breathe. But she said she had a mother-in-law who survived the 1980 flu pandemic. So just the idea that, you know, there are all these things that come up, and, you know, if everybody kind of works together, you can come out the other side for the better. But, you know, as we know, the drive to get COVID 19 vaccinations hasn't been quite as widely accepted.
We're talking with Associated Press reporter Dan Sewell. You can read this very long report, very interesting report, online, wherever you find the Associated Press, including at the Inquirer. Dan, you're the AP reporter based in Cincinnati.
Yes.
For now, your days are numbered as a reporter, at least as a full-time one. You've announced your retirement.
That is correct, yes. As of July 1st, I will be no longer waking up every morning.
Well, let's hope you're still waking up.
Yeah. Waking up with something to do, put it that way. I hope to have some mornings when I can, you know, wake up and say, huh, I wonder what I would do today.
Yeah, well, that sounds very appealing, but you've been at this a long time. I understand 44 years in the business.
Right. I was with the Inquirer 5 years and the AP 39 years. Kind of, maybe I should have tried a different company just for the, but I had the interesting experience. I was hired by the Inquirer 3 different times and hired by the AP 3 different times. So
now, do you just outlast your welcome, do you think? And they kind of trade you back and forth?
Right. Yeah. I would say that's a good thing. Although I wouldn't want to risk to hang around for needing to do it a fourth time. So.
Well, let me ask you, I mean, that more than 4 decades in the news business is quite a career. Do you have a favorite memory?
Oh, gosh, there's so many. But, you know, I covered a lot of really big stories because the AP, that's what we do, you know, hurricanes, you know, the worst of the hurricanes, Katrina and Andrew, the invasion of U.S. invasion of Grenada, Ted Bundy, just, you know, I could, the Kennedy Smith rape trial in Palm Beach. I could go on. But I was, somebody asked me my favorite story. And actually, my favorite story was about snake handlers in Georgia. I had seen a clip about someone who had died after being bitten by a snake during one of these church services, and he refused medical treatment. So I called and arranged to come to a service with the photographer, and you know, I did a lot of other interviews too. But it was just fascinating. It's just kind of an interesting exercise in seeing how people believe a very specific thing out of the Bible, just literally, and build a, you know, build their services around it. I remember when they were dancing with the rattlesnakes, I was getting closer because I wanted to hear what they were saying. And all of a sudden I realized, hey, that rattlesnake is really, really close to me.
That would have shortened your career a little bit.
Right. And the unfortunate epilogue of that story was the pastor of the church called me and said, well, you know, I really appreciated the story, but it said my insurance company saw it and they've canceled my life policy.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
they didn't realize that he was that kind of pastor.
How long ago was that?
Oh, gosh, that was in the 1990s.
Okay, so Georgia. This was before viral videos. So, I mean, this had to get out there somehow.
Right, right.
All right. Well, Dan, I imagine that you've talked to a lot of journalism students over the course of your career. At this point, with all the knowledge you have and understanding of the landscape as it exists in the news world now, what's your advice for those who want to go into the business that you've loved for so long?
Well, I think that's the first key. You know, you really have to love it. You know, it's like we say, it's not for the pay or the hours. So, yeah, you really have to love journalism. And, you know, I think that we face a lot of, you know, threats right now in all the disinformation, the misinformation, drumming up, you know, hatred and distrust of the media, which, you know, we just saw, we still see it from, you know, former presidents. So, those are all big challenges, but it's, you know, still considered a noble profession. So I hope there will be many young listeners who will follow our paths.
And where's the first place you're going to go where you don't have an assignment to do?
You know, we have a list of places. I do want to go back to Grenada at some point because I spent so much of my life there in the year leading up to the invasion and afterwards. So I'm just kind of curious to see what it looks like. And then I think a lot of the Western United States I've never been to. So I want to see, you know, like North Dakota and Wyoming and, you know, Yellowstone and things like that.
Well, we wish you all the best, Dan Sewell from the Associated Press, retiring at the end of this month after 44 years in journalism. Dan, congratulations on your long and illustrious career, and thank you so much for spending part of your Friday with us. We appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much.
And we made it to Friday here at Cincinnati Edition. We're so glad you spent so much of your week with us. You can find more of our program online at wvxu.org. I'm Michael Monks. We'll talk again on Monday.